society, you know, here and there, okay? Is it possible for the men just look at her as an intellectual entity and not the attractive one?
Definitely, yes.
Is it possible from the side of the men?
Yes.
I mean, this is the ideal world you are picturing, okay? This must be so, but I think it is not possible.
The problem is the way women are being presented in a society and the way they think
don't you think they should appear in the society. Don't you think that the role of the women is defined somewhere else rather than this, the very society?
Kitchen?
No, I'm not talking about the kitchen. Okay? See, can I as a man be a mother?
No.
No, I cannot be a mother. Okay?
Yeah.
Can I bear a child for 9 months? Can I breastfeed her or him, the child? I cannot do that. Believe me.
Yes, that's the
maybe one
difference.
Day
yes.
Science gets the man to a level. I don't know. It's impossible. But making a man who can be pregnant or something like that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I do not do that. So just consider this 9 months of pregnancy of the women, okay? It brings its own powers, potentials, and talents for the women, which is not defined in the society but somewhere else. I do want to say that the women must be in the kitchen. Men also be in the kitchen too. But I think that the main role and the main responsibility that is put on the shoulder of a woman is nurturing,
isn't it?
The children and looking after that, and also the husband.
Women are definitely better equipped for that.
Okay.
With the, like, they are more compassionate in general.
Yes.
They are more loyal to the family. That's definitely the case.
Yes.
But, and definitely we're not going to have more coal miners in the female side than men. But I don't think there's any problem with having more female mathematicians, for example.
No problem.
Female philosophers.
No problem with that.
No problem.
And in Islam...
Then we're looking at the intellectual, the spirit side of human, which is the same in men and women.
Okay.
I think one more sentence to finalize the whole discussion. I think respected Sheikh wanted to, while strengthening the social role of the women, indirectly actually looks at the role of the main role of a woman as a mother in her main role in upbringing of a child, and also her role in a house as a small society. So this society can be looked at and applied to a bigger one, to like the society that people are in. So all in all, the main role of women from an Islamic perspective is upbringing of a child, and at the same time the role of a mother, and she or the lady and all the women are even allowed to have their own role in society, to continue their education like men and to do whatever it deems necessary in a society. But I think there was a misunderstanding between us to see that all of the women are obliged to do so. No, some who believe
but
that...
But believe me, managing it is very difficult. Considering a woman who is working 7 to 9 and just getting home, not having enough time for the husband and the wife, and not, not doing the chores of the house, and it's misplaced now. The women are working outside, the men are inside the house.
We are actually talking about its theoretical basis. Is it actually Islamically allowed for her to work in society in an Islamic way, while, as the Sheikh said, leaves gender at home?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is possible, Islamically speaking. But what is the outcome and consequences? This is something at a second step that we need to discuss it.
Okay. I think giving value...
Yes, exactly. Yes. With everything, you have to be rational.
Yes.
Like, we're not giving prescriptions to every single woman or every single man.
Mm-hmm.
Or, fatherhood is very important. We
yes.
have psychological papers now that say if fathers are not present in a family, children will not be as organized.
Yes.
They will not be disciplined. So a mother cannot play that role.
That's
but,
right.
But do and we say that the main role of man in general is fatherhood? Yes, in the house,
And please,
man is better to be a father, and woman should be the mother, right? Yeah. And no one questions that. But what about the society?
But I do want to say that the West is criticizing the Muslims nowadays because they are looking after the women and men according to their own definition. They have the same sex parents
but
now.
That, that's not just about the woman. It's about the family. Like, the role of family is becoming weaker and weaker in the Western society.
Okay.
If we fix that, we might be able to have a tranquil and rational equilibrium between men and women in the society.
Just look at how's the family defined nowadays in the Western world. For example, the same sex parents. I mean, a child having two women as the parents, or two men as the parents, or single parent family. These are all, come on, they're new forms of the families, and you have to accept that, do you want it or not. Come on, man, bullshit. I think bullshit. This is not the family we are looking for. This is not the value system. Judging the women and men according to their own values, potentials, and talents is possible. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. If non-Muslims want to be more familiar with the Islamic look at the women and men, they have to get to the original sources and not the media, okay? This is the case, definitely. And we have so many verses of the Holy Quran and the Hadith giving importance to the position of men and women as the same in the society. Even in the Holy Quran, the title, men and women, are repeated 24 times as equal to each other. So the Quran also did justice towards the role of the men and women in the society. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali, for a nice elaboration regarding the topic of position of men and women in the society according to the speeches of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN/Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Kandahar mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group.
I think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
The recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, the Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the U.S. is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the U.S. is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India, and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims.
The recent daily bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's most repressed political group, the Yellow Vests, have just premiered what they are calling Season 2. In some 300 cities and towns, they have planned to demonstrate in mass numbers for the first time in more than 1.5 years due to the coronavirus restrictions. 3 years ago, the Yellow Vests first donned the reflective protective gear required in French cars to protest regressive gas tax hikes amid record petrol prices. This week, energy costs hit all-time highs in multiple areas.
After 3 years, nothing has changed, except for the fact that things have gotten even worse for the average French person. Life has gotten so much more expensive, but Macron doesn't even care. He doesn't see the demands of the Yellow Vests, or even the French people, as worthy of his attention.
The Yellow Vests were not only the biggest essentially class-based political movement in the Western 21st century, but they were also incredibly popular. 30 other countries started their own Yellow Vest movements. French polls showed them consistently around a 60% approval rating, and that's despite a constant mainstream media campaign against them. They were falsely smeared with charges of xenophobia, but they held marches against anti-Semitism, while their Paris demonstration was led by a banner of a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. President Emmanuel Macron's hardline policy against them provoked international condemnation.
From November 2018 until June 2019, nearly every Saturday in Paris was a scene of massive state repression. The world was shocked by French-style democracy, which uses indiscriminate tear gassings, rubber bullets, and violence against unarmed protesters while still claiming to be a beacon of political and human rights.
We were so numerous in the beginning, but when people began to see how violent and ferocious the government repressed the Yellow Vests, then many got too scared to protest. The government did everything they could to make us disappear, just so they can govern us according to their selfish whims.
The Yellow Vests' list of major demands are basically a call for an entire rethink of French politics, with everything from leaving the European Union, Eurozone, and NATO, to redistribution of France's enormous wealth, to green energy requiring open public debates and referendums. The Yellow Vests say they'll keep marching in the Saturdays to come, which may prove decisive during the presidential election in April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hezbollah held a funeral procession for three of the seven people who were killed by the far-right Lebanese Forces political party led by Samir Jaja. As the families of the victims awaited to bid their loved ones farewell, the slogans were those of grief and pious patience. One of the martyrs, Maryam Farhat, a mother of five, was shot in the head while she was in the comfort of her own home. Her sister says her blood will protect Lebanon from any sedition.
God bless her soul. She has made us proud. And may God give us and her children patience. I want to tell those that are sowing sedition in the country not to think about it too hard, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not allow it. He is the one safeguarding this country.
Hezbollah officials attended the funeral. The highlight of the event was a speech by head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashim Safiyuddin, who directly accused the Lebanese Forces Party of being behind the shootings.
The Lebanese Forces Party's acts are aimed at initiating a new civil war in Lebanon. This is not new for us. In the past, we warned against such plots without naming anyone. All this sectarian incitement and provocation in the media was only to drag people to internal fighting. Today, they have uncovered their true faces. His masters have hurriedly taken this step to drag the country to a civil war.
The master of the killers, he says, is the United States administration.
This is only one episode of the many episodes that are being orchestrated by the United States of America and is funded by some Arab countries. If you go back to the records of the Civil War, they all mention that the U.S. backs and pushes for such acts and Arab states fund it. They are repeating the same episode.
Sayyid Safiyuddin said Hezbollah will not allow anyone to take Lebanon to the misery that the previous generations lived during the time of the civil war, while also calling for justice for the martyrs.
Hezbollah has buried the martyrs who fell in yesterday's shootings, and though the people have chanted that the blood of the innocent will not be in vain, the method of retaliation will not be by taking arms against fellow Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Education is considered a fundamental right in the 27-nation European Union, but questions are being raised around the effectiveness of school curriculums. The number of young people who find themselves without a job in the bloc is growing.
We look for jobs. It's very hard to find, especially in the pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs. So it's even harder now to find a job.
What do you think?
I think it's not only about jobs. We didn't go to university for 2 years. And people graduated from home. It's an event of a lifetime, and they didn't get to do it.
Nearly all my friends don't have jobs, and the ones who have are paid an absolute misery, because it's not only the having or not having a job, it's having a decent pay.
EU Jobs Commissioner Nicola Schmidt attended a meeting of EU employment ministers on Friday. During an online press conference following the meeting, we pointed out that youth unemployment was already out of control in several EU nations prior to the pandemic, namely in Greece, Spain and Italy.
How confident can we be now that solutions can be found after the pandemic, when we couldn't really find solutions before the pandemic?
Many sectors are desperately looking for skilled person, for skilled people, and they do not find them. And this shows us that there are major mismatches on our labour market.
So the Commissioner believes reskilling for the digital age is the answer, but the European Commission has been talking about that now for almost a decade. Economists are saying official EU youth unemployment data at present is misleading. COVID-19 financial supports have been keeping jobs alive, but these government programmes are now being withdrawn. A potential tsunami of job losses is being forecast. The vast majority of those in precarious employment are young adults. Associated mental health issues and homelessness are big concerns. An EU social summit is scheduled for next Wednesday. Civil society organisations say the problems are well known. It's time, they say, to finally find solutions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Angry and grieved, Afghan expatriates in Iran gathered to mourn the loss of dozens of their fellow citizens who were killed in a deadly bomb attack on a Shia mosque in the Afghan province of Kunduz last Friday. Claimed by Daesh terrorists, the assault was the deadliest since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001.
I offer my condolences to my sad nation. We are all grieved for the loss of our fellow citizens. What wrong have they done? They were praying peacefully. The terrorists must be brought to justice.
The Taliban are accountable for what's happening.
If they want to form a government, they must be able to ensure the security of our nation. Unfortunately, we heard that another terrorist attack was carried out today in another mosque. The Taliban must stop further terror attacks.
More than 150 people lost their lives in the attack at Ghazar-e-Sayyedabad Mosque in the Khanabad area of Kunduz. A Daesh terrorist masquerading as a worshipper detonated his explosives during Friday prayers. The victims were all Hazara Shias, the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, something which is viewed as an attempt by Daesh to ethnically cleanse the country of Hazara Shia community.
The terrorists seek to eliminate the Shia population from Afghanistan. I wonder why the international community is silent about this massacre. Why is the West keeping mum?
Others see the bigger picture. They say the attack is masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
Certainly, the U.S. is behind the terror attacks in my country. It seeks to destabilize Afghanistan to imply that without American troops, Afghanistan will face troubles.
Friday's attack is the first since the Taliban announced an interim government in Kabul last month. Iranian officials have repeatedly insisted on the formation of an inclusive government as a way to rid the country of terrorism, bolster public security, and pave the way for a peaceful Afghanistan.
People view the deadly attack as a legacy from years of American presence on the Afghan soil. They also warn of its domino effect, saying all eyes are now on the Taliban to punish the perpetrators and prevent the recurrence of such incidents, to prove that they're capable of bringing peace to Afghanistan. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas held a big rally following the Friday prayers to mark the 10th anniversary of a prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime. Over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners were exchanged for Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in October 2011. Palestinians demand the release of all prisoners in Israeli prisons. Hamas is reportedly holding captive at least four Israeli soldiers and refuses to give any information about them until Israel releases all Palestinian prisoners who were rearrested following the Shalit swap deal.
We salute the Palestinian resistance who made us proud in 2011. Capturing Israeli soldiers has given our people great hope to release our prisoners. The Qassam Brigades managed to keep Gilad Shalit in custody for 5 years and continues to keep additional Israeli soldiers in Gaza over the past 7 years.
Participants in the rally criticized some Arab countries in the Persian Gulf for the normalization of ties with Israel and their silence towards the plight of Palestinian prisoners. Former Palestinian prisoner Amin Altel from the occupied West Bank called for more prisoner exchange deals to secure the release of all Palestinian prisoners.
As we mark the 10th anniversary of the swap deal, we pray to Almighty God to bless us with another swap deal. We also want the whole world to know that the resistance has forced Israel into releasing our prisoners. 10 years after my release, I'm confident that the Palestinian resistance factions are capable of carrying out another deal to release more prisoners and humiliate Israel.
Palestinians say that more prisoner exchange deals will be made in the near future to free all Palestinian prisoners. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of eliminating Al-Qaeda terrorists who were being supported by the then Taliban government. Washington spent $2 trillion in maintaining its military presence, but at a heavy human cost. Over 6,000 Americans and more than 100,000 Afghans were killed and millions of others displaced. But the U.S. never achieved its stated goals. Rather, fled from Afghanistan, leaving the country again in the hands of the Taliban. Now the Taliban are facing a multitude of challenges. One of the main tasks before the group is how to fix the economy, as nearly half of the population is in need of foreign assistance. Humanitarian organizations have already warned that the country is on the brink of collapse. But perhaps a more pressing issue is security. Although Afghanistan has witnessed sectarian violence for decades, deadly incidents have increased since a Daesh terror group emerged in the country at the height of the U.S. military campaign. the Taliban have failed to put an end to such carnages after they rose to power in the war-ravaged country a few months ago. Last Friday, more than 100 worshippers were killed or wounded in a Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia congregation mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The tragedy struck again on October 15th, this time in Kandahar, where a series of explosions inside a Shia mosque left dozens of worshippers dead. Some analysts believe the United States is trying to sow the seed of sectarian strife, since an unstable Afghanistan serves Washington's interests.
Certainly, there are a number of national interests, both near and afar, that seem almost hell-bent on maintaining a state of insecurity and conflict throughout the Middle East, all the way over, certainly to Afghanistan. Certainly the U.S. Policy going back many years, going back 20 years now at least, has always been to encourage conflict in the region and maintain a state of instability. It suits Israel. It suits a number of other parties.
It's clear that somebody is trying to provoke a sectarian war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Who's going to benefit from that is, I think, the ultimate question. In Iraq, for example, there's evidence that the British, Americans, and the Israelis were setting off bombs to try to provoke a conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, so it's easier to control. Perhaps that same tactic is being employed in Afghanistan, where you have British and American agents trying to provoke a civil war to pit the Sunni and the Shia and then to help destabilize the country. And out of that, they might be able to get some sort of control.
No matter who are the perpetrators of sectarian violence in Afghanistan, one thing is for certain. The Taliban, as new rulers, need to ensure security for all ethnic and religious groups. Otherwise, neither the international community nor the Afghan people will ever see them fit to govern, and thus will continue losing their credibility.
In solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails, Palestinians held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza city, demanding an end to the recent Israeli strict treatment against the inmates. Following the recent jailbreak of six inmates from the high-security Jabal prison, Israeli regime keeps practicing inhumane policies and increasing abuse against Palestinian detainees.
We are here to send this message to our prisoners that we won't leave them alone in this battle against the Israeli regime. We won't remain silent over the violations of the rights of our inmates in Israeli jails. The international community should make an urgent action to provide protection for our prisoners.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, thousands of Palestinian detainees from Islamic Jihad have begun the open-ended hunger strike on Wednesday, protesting the Israeli violations and torture inside jails.
Following the heroic escape operation by six inmates, the Israeli regime began to intensify its inhumane torturing policies against our brothers, especially the Islamic Jihad members. Our prisoners have started their hunger strike protesting the inhumane policies of the Israeli regime.
In his speech, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, Ziyad al-Nakhala, announced the movement's readiness to respond firmly against the Israeli violations of prisoners' rights, even if this leads to a new round of violence.
We are here today to support our prisoners who have begun their hunger strike. We call on the international community to stop these violations. We warn the Israeli regime that it will face a firm response if these punitive measures are not stopped. Israel is responsible for the lives of our detainees.
About 400 prisoners who belong to the Islamic Jihad movement have begun their hunger strike with the support of other factions. The strike is in protest of Tel Aviv's inhumane measures against Palestinian prisoners, intensified following the escape of six inmates from a high-security Israeli prison last month. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Relations between the EU and Britain remain at an all-time low. The so-called Northern Ireland Protocol was agreed almost 2 years ago and is a key part of the Brexit deal. Despite having negotiated it, Boris Johnson now says the protocol is not working. The EU has just put forward proposals to alter it.
We have completely turned our rules upside down and inside out to find a solid solution to an outstanding challenge.
Under the changes, checks and controls on goods moving from Britain to Northern Ireland will be reduced by more than half. EU laws will be amended to allow medicines licensed in Britain move freely to Northern Ireland. The EU sees the protocol as essential because it prevents border controls between Ireland, which is a member of the bloc, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
The Good Friday Agreement has to be preserved and no return to a hard border. The British have to work that out with ourselves here in Europe and with Ireland, but that has to be a bottom line for us.
Since Brexit, anti-EU political parties have been established in almost every one of the bloc's 27 member states.
We're being dragged into an EU army. They're imposing laws and regulations upon us which hurt the Irish economy. And now the corporate tax regime, they're after us for that. So Ireland, as things move forward, the benefits are reducing.
Analysts say the fallout from Brexit could also spell big trouble for the United Kingdom. There's growing support in Northern Ireland for a referendum on a United Ireland. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. EU officials are currently in London to try and avert an all-out trade war between the bloc and Britain. EU Commissioner Sefcovic will travel there on Friday to meet his opposite number, British Brexit Minister David Frost. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Speaking at an energy conference in Moscow on Wednesday, 13th of October, alongside the chief executives of ExxonMobil, BP and Total, the Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to deny that his country was using its control of Europe's gas supplies to advance his nation's own interests. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Matt Lynn, writing for The Telegraph. The piece is titled, Could the West Do a Deal with Putin to Keep the Lights On This Winter? Speaking at an energy conference in Moscow on Wednesday, 13th of October, alongside the chief executives of ExxonMobil, BP and Total, the Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to deny that his country was using the control of Europe's gas supplies to advance his nation's own interests. We're not using any weapons, Vladimir Putin said. On the contrary, we are making sure gas supplies were stepped up. If there were any problems, there were all the faults of someone else. Russia was here to help with its neighbors. Well, up to a point, there is no question that Europe is gripped by an energy crisis as severe as any it has faced since the 1970s, and that the United Kingdom is right in the thick of it. Prices are soaring, energy firms are going bust, there is talk of factory closures, 3-day weeks, and rolling blackouts. In the background, and whatever his denials, Vladimir Putin, a political leader, is well-versed in the great power politics and has levers at his disposal and won't hesitate to pull them. When he denies using gas supplies as a weapon, one thing is for certain. That is precisely what he's doing. They're as much an instrument of war as his country's tanks, mortars and missiles ever were. And they are pointed at precisely the same place, the heart of the West. In truth, we're in the middle of a gas shock that is likely to be as profound as the oil shock that reshaped the world in the 1970s. For the government, as for the governments across the continent, the questions are about to come thick and fast. How did we get to this mess? How can we get out of it? And perhaps most of all, what price are we willing to pay to keep our lights turned on, our homes and public buildings warm and factories open? The United Kingdom and Europe's energy crisis has been years in the making. Over the course of the past year, wholesale gas prices have risen more than fivefold. On some days of frantic trading, prices have been soaring by 20 to 30% in a single session, a sign of a market under severe stress. The reason? The switch to cleaner, renewable energy, while welcome in itself, has meant that demand for gas, viewed by policymakers as a reliable, not too dirty transitional fuel, has been steadily increasing. The massive size of stimulus programs around the world as we recover from the COVID pandemic has translated into vast and unexpected increases in demand. A lack of wind has meant that renewable energy has not been as plentiful as expected, and gas is being used as a backup. Meanwhile, China, along with much of the developing world, has been absorbing huge quantities of gas to fuel its constantly expanding industrial machine. The development of liquefied natural gas or LNG transported around the world on huge container ships has created a global market very similar to oil. Most of the demand comes from Asia, with Europe largely an afterthought, but the trouble with being an afterthought is you don't have much security of supply. And in the background, Russia, the only country with sufficient reserves to make a real difference to the market, is widely believed to have been holding back supplies, both to maximize its leverage with the West and to remind everyone just how much the continent still relies on plentiful supplies of its energy. The result? A supply crunch, with soaring prices and bottlenecks throughout the system. Britain has been hit especially hard. We have run down our reserves of gas to a mere 4 or 5 days of supply, far less than most of our continental rivals. Pathetic, really, for a nation as important as the United Kingdom, said Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the billionaire industrialist, tersely in a television interview this week. When we closed down storage facilities, we still had backup supplies from the North Sea. We could buy extra gas relatively easily on the world market whenever we needed it. And we had rising alternative energy sources that could be ramped up if necessary. At the same time, we ran down nuclear capacity while France was still ramping it up, and our commitment to combating climate change made it virtually impossible to reopen coal mines. The British state has been caught out as hopelessly unprepared as this crisis deepens. Granted, there is some bad luck in the process. No one could have predicted so many factors all coming together to put pressure on gas supplies at the same time, but a crisis is always, at least in part, bad luck. The point is to be prepared for the worst, not simply to hope for the best. The United Kingdom failed to do that. Everything will depend on the weather, says Laurent Roussekas, executive director of analyst firm IHS Market. When it is really cold, Russia needs a lot more gas, and that impacts on its ability to supply Europe. There are plenty of big producers of gas. The United States, Norway, and Qatar are all major exporters of natural gas, but it is Russia that holds a quarter of the world's entire proven supply, and a network of pipelines that make it the crucial player. In private, ministers and officials concede that since Russia is the world's largest exporter of natural gas, the amount it puts onto the market affects the global wholesale price. And some already believe that that is being turned into political leverage. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace told The Telegraph last week that energy was being used as a weapon by foreign states, although he was careful not to point the finger directly at the Kremlin. While the Tory frontbencher, Lord Agnew of Alton, this week went further, arguing outright that soaring energy costs were the result of a geopolitical move by Russia to put pressure on Europe. We are less vulnerable to that than some of our neighbours. Unlike mainland Europe, Britain does not rely on Russia for physical supplies of natural gas. The vast majority in the United Kingdom comes from British territorial waters, with the rest from reliable import partners such as Norway and Qatar and other nations in the Middle East, while less than 3% comes from Russia. Very little physical Russian gas comes to the United Kingdom because it makes no sense to transport these molecules all the way from Russia to the United Kingdom in the absence of certainty provided by medium or long-term contracts. Katya Yefimova, senior research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, told The Telegraph. Officials agree, we are not dependent on Russian oil or gas whatsoever. There is no concern about security of supply. This is a question of high global gas prices, a senior government source told The Telegraph. Europe gets about 41% of its gas from Russia. They are massively exposed to the threat of leverage from Moscow. The United Kingdom is fortunate enough to have sovereign access to gas reserves in the North Sea in the way that many European countries don't have. So we are far more insulated than our European partners. Officials may be breezily optimistic, but that is not the whole story. While the United Kingdom imports relatively little natural gas from Russia right now, the latter's decisions to a large extent determine the global price, and that in turn determines whether Britain can buy the supplies it needs from anywhere. Even worse, right now there is very little that anyone can do to get out of the situation. On the supply side, there is not much Europe can do, argues Simone Tagliapietra, a senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel Institute. How bad will it get? We expect the price to rise as a consequence of tight supply, says Tom Marzek-Manser of the energy consultancy firm ICIS. And that will be the main way that market copes with the issue. We have already seen some industrial shutdowns in Europe as prices rise, and we can see more of that. Once that happens, demand will start to fall. And yet, if that doesn't work, then no one really knows for sure right now what will happen. It is easy to start sketching out doomsday scenarios. We could see shutdowns, with heating and gas stoves turned off. Pensioners could die of the cold, while the rest of us put on extra coats and heat up our dinner in the microwave, assuming that electricity network is still running. In reality, it probably won't get to that point. As a first option, the government could start restricting supply to industrial users, which accounts for up to 20% of overall demand. Industries such as chemicals, paper, packaging, and building materials, all big energy users, could see factories put on three-day weeks. After that, schools and offices could also be put on three-day week to save energy. And so could retailers. A shopping mall takes a lot of heating in winter, and then possibly closed completely. That would take a huge amount of pressure off the system. After that, they could be the kind of staggered blackouts we saw back in the 1970s, designed to eke out meager supplies throughout the winter. It wouldn't be great, but it would mean the heating would keep running for most families. But this would still be a catastrophe for the government. The last Prime Minister to put the country on a three-day week amid an energy crisis was the man who took us into the European Union, Sir Edward Heath. Historians might see a certain irony in the symmetry of the one who took us out of the European Union, Boris Johnson, repeating that humiliation. But few people would find it funny, and it would destroy any reputation of basic competence. In these circumstances, could Boris Johnson be tempted to ever strike a deal with Vladimir Putin to keep the lights on?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the book The Inner Voice, Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi aptly explains the need for a man to understand his purpose in life and to be able to ponder over some of the important aspects of our journey in reaching nearness to Allah. Today, we will read to you an excerpt of this book. Stay with us. God-mindedness. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Holy Quran. This phrase occurs at the beginning of every chapter of the Quran except one. It is used by Muslims before starting every work, before reading, before eating, before starting their work, before sleeping. Islam teaches men to start every good effort with the holy name of God, who is beneficent and merciful, invoking His mercy to bless His efforts with success. The goal of Islam is to make a man God-minded. It wants him to realize that he himself is nothing, that all his efforts are fruitless unless rewarded by God with success. And that realization is combined with the satisfaction that God is beneficent and merciful, who will not disappoint him in his hope and belief. It is very amusing to note that the common image of Islam in the eyes of non-Muslims is that of a religion whose God is wrathful, like the God of the Old Testament, inflicting punishment on the spur of the moment. Do a mistake and you get a jolly good bang on your head. They fail to realize that the very first sentence of the Quran describes God as beneficent and merciful. And that formula is used by every Muslim hundreds of times every day. And the Muslims believe that by invoking the mercy of God, they get limitless blessings of God in this world as in the world hereafter. Once, the Holy Prophet, while passing a graveyard, ordered his companions to get out of it in haste. On their return journey, he asked them to walk slowly. On being asked the reason of his first order and then of its change next time, the Prophet informed them that there was a man being chastised in one of those graves on account of his wickedness. I did not like to remain in a place where a human being was being punished, though he was a wrongdoer. Fortunately, at the moment the child of that dead person was taken to a teacher to start his education, the teacher told him to recite, "In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful." As soon as the innocent child invoked the mercy of Allah, the command came to the angels to change the punishment into the blessing of God. Reason: it is not becoming to my mercy to punish the parent while his son calls me the Beneficent and Merciful. So in the return journey, the Prophet walked in that graveyard with comfort, glorifying the mercy and benevolence of the Almighty God. Let us turn towards God every time we begin a work. The word Bismillah, in the name of God, may mean also for the sake of God and to the service of God. Thus, this formula, if comprehended fully, will serve also to save us from wrong action and misdeed. Certainly, it will be illogical to commit a mischief for the sake of God and to His service. Let us remember God, and we will become free of sins and errors. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an excerpt from the book Inner Voice by Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi. Our website is parstoday.com. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.